What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. We are so thrilled to be here with you. We have an amazing show for you today. We are so excited to be bringing back some great friends of the show. And if you can become Patreon supporters, please do that at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, and you get bonus interviews, extended interviews. This week, you will be getting a short mini interview with Jeremy Corbyn. And as people know, we're working on this documentary about Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. So we interviewed Jeremy Corbyn for that. And so you'll have to wait until the movie comes out to see a bunch of that. But we are giving you a little bit, a couple moments from that interview. So that'll be great. Also, I think that's all there is. And if you can't afford $5 a month, and can only do $1 a month, that's still very helpful. We literally couldn't do the show without your Patreon support. So you can do $12 a year and make the show happen. And that, again, is at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Also, much of the second segment of this show will be Patreon only. So if you're watching live, you'll get to see the whole show. If you're watching this later and you want to see our segment on Bush Cheney, then you can do that at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. All righty. So let us bring on our first guest. So excited to be bringing him back onto the show. He is an international human rights lawyer and former senior United Nations official. He left the UN in October of 2023, penning a widely read letter that warned of genocide in Gaza, criticized the international response, and called for a new approach to Palestine and Israel based on equality, human rights, and international law. And he is Craig McIver. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Katie. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining.
Pleasure.
So you actually have two recent pieces to talk about. Both were published at the great website Mondo Weiss. Let's start off with the one that you had written earlier. Western media can be held legally accountable for its role in the Gaza genocide. So tell us what made you write this piece. And for those of us, well, I have read it. For those watching who haven't read it, can you lay out your argument?
Well, yeah, essentially, I think I have been as horrified by Western media coverage of the genocide in Palestine as has anyone who has been paying attention. If there's any peace in all of this, it's that, you know, subscription rates and the number of people who actually follow these Western media corporations has been declining over a period of many years. But they are still important outlets of information that have a very significant impact on not just the public consciousness in the West, but the policies of Western countries. And the sort of absolute propagandistic nature of Western corporate media reporting on the genocide in Palestine for almost a year now is, I think, nothing short of shocking. I think plenty of people have said that it is unethical from a journalistic point of view. And I was making the point that some of it may also be unlawful, that there are precedents in international law in particular for holding media companies and media personalities accountable for things like incitement to genocide, incitement to violence more generally. And when you see some of the examples that we've been witnessing in the last 11 months, there's a real possibility that some of these these media actors may have crossed that line. And the basic argument that I've been making, which is a legal argument, and that's reflected in the piece that I did for Mondaways, one is that genocide and incitement to genocide, if it's direct and public, are international crimes, defined very clearly as international crimes. Two, Israel is committing genocide. It's on trial for genocide, and it's very likely it will be found that genocide is being committed. It could not commit that genocide without U.S. complicity or U.K. complicity, some of the others, but the U.S. in particular. And the third piece, U.S. complicity could not be sustained without U.S. media support and incitement in all of this. So the role that the media is playing is not academic. It actually is playing a role in, let's say, manufacturing consent for what's happening in Palestine. The third thing that I argument that I make is that these media companies know exactly what's happening on the ground, and they know what they're doing to obscure it, and they know what they're doing to support it. So in legal terms, the acts that they're perpetrating knowingly. This is not just mere negligence or a lack of journalistic ethics. They know very well how they are misrepresenting what's happening on the ground. Also, I think legally important, I've argued that these are highly influential and powerful companies, and they are publicly and systematically disseminating propaganda for genocide, including disinformation, dehumanization of the Palestinians, incitement to violence in some cases, covering up for war crimes, and so on. And then finally, you know, why this is not just academic, there is a direct nexus between these media acts and harms on the ground. First, because some of these mainstream print outlets and mainstream broadcast outlets are where U.S. officials and U.S. policymakers go to get their news and analysis. And these folks are actually directly involved in providing arms and cover to the crimes that Israel is perpetrating. And also consuming what these media companies are producing are dual U.S.-Israeli nationals who are shuttling back and forth and actually participating in the killing. So I've said, you know, the nexus between what these media companies are saying and the harms that are being caused on the ground is much more direct than these companies might like to admit. And so I've just raised the question as to whether or not we don't need to see some real accountability from these companies. And there's a long tradition going all the way back to Nuremberg, for example, on holding media accountable for incitement to genocide or complicity in crimes against humanity and so on. And this was very much in the minds of the framers of international legal instruments, beginning with the establishment of the UN in 1945, who were very explicit in international human rights treaties, for example, to say that you cannot use your right to free speech, for example, as a weapon to destroy other rights of people, including the right to life itself. That is not protected speech. And when it came time then to draft the Genocide Convention, a separate crime of incitement to genocide was included in that convention. And importantly, that applies not just to states and state actors, but to private actors as well, importantly so. And the other thing that the article talks about are precedents in international law. So, you know, the infamous case of the Nazi publisher Julius Streicher, for incitement and persecution on political and racial grounds, because his publication, Der Stürmer, during the genocide against European Jews, was broadcasting all of this kind of inciting material. And he was, in fact, found guilty at Nuremberg for incitement to murder and extermination. That trend of looking at also the role of media was very important when the International Tribunal for Rwanda, covering the Rwanda genocide, was pronouncing. And it, in fact, found a number of media people accountable. The infamous Mille Collines television and radio company, the Kangura newspaper, three different people were found guilty of incitement to genocide, in that case, by the tribunal. And the judges in that tribunal at the time, you know, made a very strong point that these people were aware of what they were doing. They were aware of the power of their words, and they were aware of the reach of the medium of communication that they had, that it was broadly disseminated because they were using media with broad reach there. And, you know, Judge Pillay famously said, without a firearm, machete, or any physical weapon, you caused the death of thousands of innocent civilians. And in my piece, I say it's important that we recall that Der Stürmer knew what they were doing, Mil Colleen knew what they were doing. And today, these media companies in the West, they also know what they are they're doing. They're not the same as those companies, but some of their acts definitely cross that line, not just of ethical journalism, but potentially of legal liability as well, because it is not arguable that, you know, this live-streamed genocide that's unfolding on the screens of everybody around the world, it's not credible to suggest that these companies are not aware of the realities on the ground and what they're doing to obscure them. And when you see what they're doing in the face of this, you know, systematically hiding the genocide from their offices, dehumanizing Palestinians, using dehumanizing language and narratives, insulating Israel from accountability. And even none of this has changed, even as the World Court has said that there's a plausible case of genocide, or the ICC prosecutor has asked for arrest warrants for crimes against humanity, or all the international human rights mechanisms have rung the alarm. Rather than reporting on these things, these media companies have suppressed that information and continue to press for a very non-credible narrative in what's happening here. So, you know, all of this taken together means that they are actually playing an active role, in my view, in what's happening on the ground. I say in the article that if you get your news from cable news stations in the U.S. Or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Fox or CNN, you will have no idea. If that's the only place that you're getting your news, you'll have no idea that the Israeli leadership have repeatedly proclaimed their genocidal intent publicly. You know nothing. You'll still believe the false stories that were circulated in Western media about 40 beheaded Israeli babies, those stories that are long proven to be fabricated, but you'll be also unaware of the actual beheaded Palestinian babies, the many cases there. You'll know nothing about the systematic killing of Palestinian civilians. You may not know about the torture camps, a systematic rape of Palestinian detainees, that snipers targeting children. All of these things that define the reality of what's happening on the ground have been shielded. And instead, what you have been given through these outlets is this, sometimes I've said, transparently false disinformation and propaganda from pro-Israel sources, or frankly, from the talking heads on these networks themselves, just uncritically publishing justifications for war crime, distractions from the daily atrocities, and censoring the actual stories of genocide, suppressing the voices of Palestinians and others. And, you know, we've seen the reports put out about how some of these outlets actually censor specific words. Some can't say the word Palestinian, according to the editorial guidelines that they impose on their journalists. And I want to say, too, there have been uprisings in Western corporate media companies in the U.S., in the U.K., in Europe, and elsewhere, from principal journalists who see this happening and who have been speaking out, but they have been subjected to, I think, unprecedented, at least unprecedented since the McCarthy era, oppression by their own companies, their own media companies, to silence them, sometimes to fire them altogether. And so I just think it's important for all of us to speak out on what's happening there. The other thing that I'm very careful to say in this case is we do not want to address this in a way that would in any way erode the already shaky guarantees of free expression and free speech. Because we know that whenever there is a crackdown on free speech. It's going to be us. It's going to be the people who are speaking against power, who are rejecting the official narrative, who are trying to defend, in this case, the Palestinians, who are going to suffer from any restrictions on free speech. But free speech does not protect incitement to war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. Those can be subject to criminal accountability. And even before you get to criminal accountability, there is legal and then non-legal action that can be taken to hold these companies to account for their participation in this genocide. But that's kind of the essence of it. It's a bit longer piece than that. But yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. I think that there's a really interesting, for me at least, like the test case is the way that the rape story is weaponized. Because you could say, well, these people are just ignorant, like Dana Bash and Jake Tapper, who talk a lot about the alleged rape committed by Hamas. They really don't know about the actual rape committed by Israeli soldiers, but that's not true because the Israeli media itself covers it. So there's obviously a conscious choice for this media in the West to not cover that. But I wanted to actually show what happened to Dana Bash. And again, I think Dana Bash is a great example of this media malpractice, which is probably an understatement, but this media complicity that you address in your piece. Let's take a look at what happened to Dana Bash a couple days ago at an event for her book.
I've been dying in Gaza, and you have not been reporting it. You call yourself a good journalist, report the truth, but instead you want millions from Zionists. You want millions from AIPAC. You're taking millions, and you're living in that house all alone, that multi-million dollar house. You're taking it to spew lies about the Palestinian people, to lie about amputees. You lie about people who have been bombed in hospitals. You lie about the students in the encampments. They are just trying to exercise their free speech to help their family and friends back home. We have tried to sit with politicians day after day, and they don't listen to us. And meanwhile, our family and friends are dying. What else are we supposed to do if this was happening to your family? Stay!
Correct. Okay. Protesting is terrific. And at the same time, you allow the time to speak.
Okay, so that's what happened. And she basically was calling out Dana Bash's bias coverage of what's happening. Now, let's see what Jake Tapper said in response to what was done. And Jake Tapper is, of course, Dana Bash's colleague at CNN. These protesters target Dana at her home and this event because she's Jewish. There is nothing about her coverage of the Israel-Hamas war that is different from most other news coverage covering both Jewish, Israeli, and Palestinian pain. This harassment is anti-Semitism. Now, on the one hand, he's actually saying something he doesn't realize, which is that it's true. The bias that Dana Bash is showing is not only demonstrated by Dana Bash. She's not the only person doing it. But I would say she has a special place in hell. Or she's especially egregious when it comes to this bias. I'd say the bias is pervasive, but there are different levels of it. And I think one of the most disturbing examples of this, but it was also very useful because it made it so clear the way that the rape allegations are used to distract from Israel's crimes. We saw this back in the winter during an interview that Dana Bash did of Pramila Jayapal. So let's take a look at this clip, number three.
15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, three quarters of whom are women and children.
And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping
Well, Dana,
Palestinian
I think
women.
We're not.
Okay. So first of all, she's basically saying, well, yeah, that sucks. But at the same time, at least Israelis don't go around raping Palestinian women the way that Hamas rapes Israeli women, which is not true. And in fact, that has been debunked because we know that all those, it's not about believe women because not a single woman came forward about rape on October 7th. Someone did claim sexual assault during a period of captivity. That's true, that there's one example of that. But the narrative of mass rape committed on October 7th has just fallen apart. But what's interesting is I actually showed this in a tweet that not only has that not been corrected by Dana Bash, but if you see, there's still a tweet up there. There's still an article which has this video embedded. Bash calls out silence over Hamas's use of sexual violence. So they're saying that Pramila Jayapal, basically they're implying, is silent about Hamas's sexual violence. I mean, the fact that is still up there is shocking to me. But what makes it even more atrocious is not just that the story that she's pushing has been debunked. What makes it even more atrocious is that these people who claim to care about rape have not reported on the videotaped gang rape of a Palestinian detainee. They haven't reported on the protests that have been coined the right to rape protests that broke out after the Israeli police dared to detain some soldiers accused of raping inmates at Sde Tamon. They haven't covered the fact that a member of the Knesset said it was, quote, legitimate to insert sticks into someone's rectum. They haven't covered this other story that we'll get to where a rabbi is basically blessing a soldier accused of rape. And again, these are stories that the Israeli media has covered. So this is, to me, like a controlled experiment. It would be one thing if these stories were not covered anywhere except in independent media. Sorry, that was really more me ranting than, I guess, a question. But what say ye?
I think it's one of the clearest examples, because this is the pattern that we've seen for all of these months. You will see, and frankly, you know, Dana Bash and Jake Tapper are two of the worst, just outright propagandists that we have seen. I don't watch CNN, but I've tuned in to watch some of these examples, and I've seen them justifying war crimes. I've seen them non-critically just parroting the talking points of the Israeli government and the Israeli military. I've seen them reporting false stories about atrocities alleged to have been committed by Hamas and then proven later to have been entirely fabricated. I've seen them quoting sources that have been long since discredited, right? Azaka and others. And the contrast between, on the one hand, the reporting by these folks of allegations of a campaign of systematic rape by Hamas on October 7th, which has not been proven in spite of several investigations, and the evidence for which that has been put forward has been repeatedly debunked as false, fabricated, and so on, and where there have been independent investigations that have found no systematic rape. I always say it's always possible that there was a rape.
Of course.
Here or there, whenever there is conflict, although that has not been proven either, by the way. And then on the other hand, documented, systematic, officially sanctioned, and publicly defended perpetration of rape by Israelis against Palestinian prisoners, not just since October 7th, but going back decades, is never, ever mentioned. So a fake story about mass and systematic rape perpetrated by Palestinians against Israelis is not withdrawn. And by the way, right, it's never been withdrawn by the New York Times and others who have perpetrated this false story. And on the other hand, actual systematic rape, which has been defended by the official Israeli sources and defended by the public and so on, not reported at all. And then people like Dana Bash going so far as to sum that all up by saying, yeah, Palestinians rape, Israelis don't, which is, you know, the goal that it takes to take it even to that level. Now, why this is all important is because this is not just bad reporting. This atrocity propaganda that has been generated since the 7th of October is generated specifically and knowingly for a particular purpose by the Israeli government and the IDF, which is to pave the ground for atrocities to be committed against Palestinians. In other words, this is necessary to dehumanize the Palestinians, create a sense of revulsion in the Western public so that Israel can commit genocide with Western support. Yeah, everyone who participates in that is contributing to the genocide, in my view. So you can't just, you know, take it and say, well, okay, so we'll just say everybody is doing bad things. No. There's a reason for this, and I think that there's a need for accountability. And can I just say, Katie, one more thing?
Yeah,
that young woman who confronted Dana Bash, that is a means of accountability as well. peacefully confronting perpetrators of incitement so that we don't normalize this kind of behavior is an important kind of accountability. You know, my hat is off to that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think what is so great about that Dana Bash example, and we're going to show some other examples of Dana Bash's bias, but in that instance in particular, she really makes it clear how, just as you described, Craig, the function of this atrocity propaganda is to almost justify the actual war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by Israel, because you're saying, well, yeah, but these people are monsters, so how much do we really care? Or these people are monsters who rape, unlike Israelis. So unfortunately, when you're dealing with animals and monsters like this, maybe you're going to have to kill 15,000 civilians. The number has obviously gone up. But, you know, it was just so telling that that was her response to Pramila Jayapal citing the killing of civilians. Why would you bring up, even if it were true, let's say it were true, when it's not, why would you bring up the mass rape that Hamas allegedly engaged in? Why is that relevant to the number of civilians killed by Israel?
You know, it's really interesting because, so in the literature, on international legal and other work that looks at the question of incitement, like incitement to genocide in particular, there are two very big trends. You know, the tendency, one is dehumanization. So you say things to dehumanize the target population so that it's easier to commit genocide against them. It's a big part of incitement, and courts have recognized it as a big part of incitement as well. There's something else which is called accusation in the mirror, which is a big part of incitement, and lawyers and others who work on the question of incitement to genocide. And incitement in the mirror is, you know, basically it's this phrase, every accusation is a confession. But the technical term for that is accusation in the mirror. And the reason that's so important, and you will see it in every genocide, including the genocide against the Jews in Europe, including the Rwanda genocide, the Bosnian genocide, Palestinian genocide, the message that they have to create is these people are coming to get you. They're coming to get your women. They're coming to threaten you. So we have to kill them first. And it is an absolute constant. And I have to say, Dana Bash is a pro at it, and so is Jake Tapper.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've never heard that term. What is it? It's accusation in the mirror?
Accusation in the mirror.
Wow. Yeah, that's fascinating, because it's a combination of projection, right? But also justifying, it's a way to attempt to turn the victim into the victimizer, which Israel is so masterful at.
And in doing so, to create a justification for victimizing that group. And that is what... That has been a central piece of the propaganda for genocide that Israel has been providing and that these outlets have been disseminating.
It's so fascinating because just talking about this with you now, it's such a meta phenomenon we're witnessing, because we're seeing the weaponization of rape to justify the genocide of Palestinians. We're also seeing the way that anti-Semitism is weaponized to whitewash what Israel is doing and what Israel's defenders are doing. So Jake Tapper's response to this is, you're attacking Dana Bash because anti-Semitism, not because she is a fellow like myself, Jake Tapper, complicit in this. I'm curious if he actually thinks that's true or if he's being totally cynical. Like, I'm curious if he's brainwashed.
I mean, you never know, but I mean, this charge of anti-Semitism is ubiquitous. I mean, anyone, I mean, it's goes without saying. I mean, anyone who speaks out against Israeli crimes is going to be called an anti-Semite. And, you know, ironically, that's anti-Semitic, right? Because it's saying that what Israel is doing is for, by, and on behalf of the Jewish people. No, it's not. There's nothing Jewish about what Israel is doing. And it doesn't commit those crimes as Jews. And when somebody like Jake Tapper tries to create the perception that it does, that you can't criticize what Israel does because what they're doing is a Jewish thing, that is, to me, the most anti-Semitic thing I can think of. Genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, summary executions, the murder of children, destruction of civilians, that's Jewish stuff. I mean, that's the most anti-Semitic thing I can think of, and Jake Tapper is guilty of that. And, you know, so I mean, not to mention the fact that the harm that this does to the cause of combating anti-Semitism, because it is totally taken the wind out of it. Everybody is used to being called an anti-Semite, you know, including Jews who are fighting against the genocide. So, yeah, it's outrageous.
So I want to show, just so we could see that Dana Bash's bias is not a one-off, let's take a look at this compilation that the great Chuck Modi, the journalist, put together. This is clip 8. It's kind of a mashup of some of Dana Bash's greatest hits.
This war is extremely complicated. What is not complicated is that there is a violent rage that is going on against Jews that we have not seen maybe even ever in America.
I'm Dana Bash. We start with destruction, violence, and hate on college campuses across the country.
I'm closer to my Judaism since I've been in this encampment, and I've also felt safer as a Jew in this encampment.
It pleases me to no end to see that you are here.
They're calling for a ceasefire. Well, there was a ceasefire on October 6th, the day before Hamas terrorists brutally murdered more than 1,000 people inside Israel and took hundreds more as hostages. You don't hear the pro-Palestinian protesters talking about that. We will.
Had a couple of Shabbat services. Been just a really beautiful experience for everyone. Never again for anyone.
15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, three quarters of whom are women and children.
And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping.
Well, Dana,
the rape of a 13-year-old boy that occurred in an Israeli prison in the Moscovia in Jerusalem. We examined these allegations. We believe they were credible. We put them to the government of Israel. And you know what happened the next day? The IDF went into the DCIP offices and removed all their computers and declared them a terrorist entity.
Because there's still over 1 million people with nowhere to go. We are not the story. The story is Gaza.
So just some great moments captured by Chuck Modi. Also, let's just show one more thing of Dana Bash. Clip 4, Brad, please.
Many of these protests started peacefully with legitimate questions about the war. But in many cases, they lost the plot. They're calling for a ceasefire. Well, there was a ceasefire on October 6th, the day before Hamas terrorists brutally murdered more than 1,000 people inside Israel and took hundreds more as hostages. This hour, I'll speak to an American-Israeli family whose son is still held captive by Hamas since that horrifying day that brought us to this moment. You don't hear the pro-Palestinian protesters talking about that.
Well, maybe because the U.S. is not funding Hamas and not justifying Hamas. Like, the idea that we think that demanding that Hamas free the captives is going to be effective versus demanding that our government stop arming Israel, not to mention the fact that we all know that Israel and Netanyahu couldn't care less about the hostages. And we know, I mean, I had on Useful Idiots last week, we had on Sarit Michieli, who works at the great human rights organization B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, and their people, their Twitter account put out an Instagram a graphic that said, you know, Netanyahu is killing hostages one by one. But anyway, that's sorry. I just can't stand that. Why aren't they talking about those people? Okay, let's just watch a little bit more. Or no, but Craig, please respond. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, two things. One is that, you know, every corporate media station, when they talk about the situation, talks about the hostages first and foremost. Right. So it's not like it's not getting coverage. And secondly, what they don't talk about is the thousands upon thousands of Palestinian prisoners who are being held in Israeli dungeons, horribly abused, without charge or trial, who are also hostages. And yet get no coverage at all. And Dana Bash wouldn't even whisper that aspect of the story. So if you hear human rights defenders in the speech speaking out on these issues, it's because their government and their government adjacent corporate media are lined up against them on the issues that they need to tell. Secondly, this is a classic case of slander. I mean, Dana Bash and so many of these other corporate voices, as a part of their strategy of insulating the genocide from accountability, have decided to slander college students and professors and human rights defenders and peace activists and others as anti-Semites and supporters of terrorism and all of these other things, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, anyone who knows anything about these demonstrations and encampments and so on will know that that Jewish protesters are disproportionately represented every single time. They can't cite a single case of anti-Semitism, not that there isn't anti-Semitism, you know, amongst some people, but in these demonstrations. And yet that simple, you know, broad brush slander of those people is carried out. And I think there needs to be accountability there too. Some of it will need to be non-legal accountability, but I don't mean unlawful accountability, but I mean, not all of it will be judicial accountability. You know, they can be called out for it, for example. But in some cases, you know, it is slander. And it subjects people to harms, to actual harms. You know, students are being kicked out of school or suspended or suffering from administrative penalties, having the police sicked on them, and sometimes being physically attacked, you know, by thugs because they're being painted as anti-Semites when they're not. So you have a false statement, slander being made against people that has been inciting and causing harm against them. They're not just inciting a genocide in Palestine, they're inciting against the human rights defenders speaking out against it. And there too, I think there needs to be accountability.
Yeah, we did a whole mashup here at the Katie Helper Show that we released that contrasts what people like Dana Bash is saying about violence against Jews. They're right that there's been violence against Jews, but the violence that against Jews has been violence against Jewish protesters defending Palestine, not the Jews who are the pro-Jewish supremacy Israel ones. The people committing violence were all police or actual Israel supporters. I mean, it was like the Twilight Zone to hear the claims that it was like an inversion of the truth, which we keep seeing on this issue. But I want to show, let's just go back to that Dana Bash clip because there's something she says that's just amazing.
Now, protesting the way the Israeli government, the Israeli prime minister is prosecuting the retaliatory war against Hamas is one thing. Making Jewish students feel unsafe at their own schools is unacceptable. And it is happening way too much right now.
Okay, then she shows something that's kind of misrepresentative, but I want to show her what she says afterwards.
Again, what you just saw is 2024 in Los Angeles. Harkening back to the 1930s in Europe, and I do not say that lightly, the fear among Jews in this country is palpable right now.
It's like Hitler, she's saying. The fact that there are people protesting for a ceasefire, the fact that there are Jewish students protesting for a ceasefire, that is a lot like Hitler.
This is where you see reality completely turned on its head in the current case. You know, the Hitler analogy cannot be used for those perpetrating genocide against a particular ethnic group or those who are supporting an ethno-nationalist ideology, but it can be used against the human rights defenders protesting against the genocide. And this is a moment in history where nothing makes sense anymore. She's absolutely one of the worst.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to give Jake Tapper some credit because, of course, Dana is not the only one. We shouldn't invisibilize or erase him. So here's a segment that Jake Tapper did, which airs claims that have been totally debunked. And, of course, he never corrected it. Let's just take a look.
Evening, Lenore introduced us to another rescue volunteer who went to other parts of Israel that day, David Bader. His first stop was Sderot. What I saw there, he tells us, people strewn, dead bodies. Dozens. At the Sha'ar HaNegev junction, I counted, there were 24 bodies, he says. There was also the body of a boy that was thrown. The stroller of the baby. Why? Why would you kill him? He tells us that Kfar Aza was like a destroyed cemetery. Dead, injured, blood everywhere in the houses, in the yards, on the street. You can't understand what I saw there, he says. It's impossible to understand. He remembers a family that had been driving in a car until terrorists killed them. The children were charred, just charred, he says. What could a child do to an adult, he asks. He was a baby, strapped into his car seat inside the car. He guessed that the terrorists took a firearm, shot and killed the members of the family, and then, with a knife, cut their throats. David responds like this to skeptics. It's a shame that those people didn't come there to see what happened on that Black Saturday, he responds. Get it out of my stomach, out of my head, everything that happened. Why do we deserve this? Dozens dead. The smell. Even now, it's still with me. I want the entire world to know, the entire world to know what Hamas did, he says. Children were killed, small children, kids that didn't even know how to say Dada or Mama. They didn't even know how to say it.
Now, none of this is in relation to anything that the Israeli government or military is doing. But these actions provide the context as to why the Israeli government has decided, with overwhelming Israeli public support, that they cannot allow Hamas to be able to carry out any future attacks on the Israeli people.
Again, he's doing exactly what Dana Bash did, right? He's saying, I'm going to cite these atrocities, which have been debunked. Of course, there were atrocities committed on October 7th, 100%. We know that. But there weren't these particular stories of the burnt babies, the beheaded babies, the rape. But we see, he says, this has nothing to do with what the Israeli government is doing, but it explains why they have to do what they're doing. He basically says that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a textbook case right there. I mean, he's doing the entire mathematical formula for you.
Right.
Hamas did these awful things, and not only the awful things they actually did, but they also did these other even more awful things that were not true. And therefore, now you understand why we have to do this to Gaza.
Right.
And he just lays it out there directly. And at the same time, you see the way that he humanizes Israeli victims with emotion in his eyes. Never, ever the case for Palestinian victims, who are exponentially more in numbers. And this is all also a part of the ISISification. Yeah. Of Hamas, right? You have to make the threat look even bigger than it is in order to justify the disproportionate response of the Israelis. So, you know, Hamas breaks out of the prison on October 7th. It overcomes and defeats the Israeli military around the Gaza Strip and in much of southern Israel. In the process, it kills a bunch of civilians unlawfully in its attacks. If that and Israel in its response kills a lot more Israel, I don't mean more than the, but kills many Israeli civilians with its Hannibal directive and its massive response, with Apache helicopters and so on, fire missiles, everything else. Now, if they had told that story, that sounds like war, right? So instead, they had to tell another story about 40 beheaded babies and babies cut out of their mothers' abdomens and mass systematic rape of all of the girls and mutilation of women's breasts and children hung on clotheslines and children put in ovens, all of which has been completely debunked as false, fabricated propaganda for genocide, because that sounds like ISIS, right?
Right.
And then, you know, with this principle of accusation in the mirror, there have not been beheaded Israeli babies on October 7th. There have been a lot of beheaded Palestinian babies by the Israelis since then. The first was reported in the Western corporate media, the latter wasn't. There has not been systematic rape of Israelis on October 7th. There has been systematic rape of Palestinian detainees since and before then. The lie was reported in Western media. The true story was not reported in Western media. All of it is about building a narrative that will allow continued Western support for the genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity that are happening in Gaza and in the West Bank. You know, pay attention, because as events increase more and more in the West Bank, you're going to see the same kind of trends coming out of this complicit Western media.
Well, Craig, you've been so generous with your time. I know you have to go. We have to bring on our next segment. But before that, we didn't have time to really dig into this, but just summarize your excellent piece that you also wrote at Mondo Weiss about how no, Israel does not have the right to self-defense.
Well, maybe we can on another day have a discussion about this, because it's very much involved. But, you know, what I point out in the article is that, you know, every Western politician and complicit media personality loves to follow every atrocity committed by the Israelis by saying, well, we believe that Israel has a right to defend itself. What I said is that's actually a double lie, because on the one hand, under international law, Israel does not have an Article 51 right to self-defense in the territories that it occupies, including Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights. It does not have a right to self-defense there. first of all. And under international law, the Palestinian people do have a right of self-defense against colonialism, apartheid, foreign occupation, and so on. And then, you know, the other half of the lie that is told when these Western politicians just repeat this mantra over and over again is that the things that they're trying to justify are not under international law justified by claims of self-defense. Like, for example, you know, genocide, to be sure, crimes against humanity, but, you know, even individual war crimes like the destruction of hospitals or torture or the siege, collective punishment, these things, you know, saying that Israel has a right to defend itself has nothing to do with these crimes because self-defense is not a justification for those crimes under international law. So we've all gotten used to just accepting that as the sort of opening preface every time there is a crime committed by Israel. Well, we believe that Israel has a right to defend itself. No, it doesn't. The Palestinian people in the occupied territories have a right to defend themselves. Israel has a right to defend itself in Israel. It does not have a right of self-defense in the occupied territories. And the Palestinian people do as a matter of international law. So I just thought it was important to set that out in legal terms and in moral terms as well. And I lay out the metaphor there that you can't, you know, a criminal can't take over somebody's home, brutalize the family, kill some members of the family, move in themselves into the home, and then if the family fights back, use self-defense as a defense for having murdered members of the family. And international law is structured the same way. So that's out on Mondo Weiss today. Happy to come back and talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. Great. Let's do it. All right. Thank you so much, Craig. Have a great night. And you're always welcome back because it's always an amazing pleasure to have you on. And just really quickly, before you leave, I want to read some of the super chats related to your segment. Julia Stryker was hung for publishing Der Stürmer, also promoting beheaded baby, systematic rape, justifying bombing hospitals, universities, etc. That's a reference, I think, to what the media is doing. So thankful for this interview. I stand Craig McIver. He's so valuable to hear. Hope he goes far. 9,000 to 13,000 Palestinian hostages in administrative detention. Craig not being shown on the MSM, on the mainstream media, speaks volumes. So yes, true. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Craig. And again, sorry we didn't have enough time to get to your second article, but we'll have you on again soon so we can get to that because it's really great.
With pleasure. Thanks for everything you're doing.
Thanks, Craig.
Take care, Katie.
Bye. All righty. Thank you, everyone who's watching. And we are going to keep the show going and it's going to be great. And as always, want to thank Craig once again for coming on, but also the amazing work he's doing and has been doing and did. And he's left the UN. He resigned for understandable reasons, but he has not stopped speaking truth to power. And so we're really grateful to him. Now we're bringing on to the show two other guests, returning guests. Dave Anthony, a comedian, also the co-host of the Dalit podcast. Josh Olson, an Oscar award-nominated screenwriter, writer of the Bronzeville podcast. And Dave and Josh co-hosted the West Wing Thing podcast and the Audit podcast. And for the Audit podcast, they sat through a George W. Bush masterclass. And that is part of what makes them experts in this conversation we're going to be having about the Cheney endorsement of Kamala Harris. So welcome, Dave and Josh. How's it going?
Hey.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello. Where were you? This is like the JFK question. Where were you when you learned that Dick and Liz Cheney had endorsed Kamala Harris?
Heaven?
I was in my living room.
Right.
I was just sitting there in my living room and then someone sent it to me.
I mean, it's fat. Let's take a look at what Dick Cheney said. And then let's take a look at some of the reactions to this nomination that we'll get into it. This endorsement, I mean. Okay. So here's what Dick said. In our nation's 248 year history, there has never been an individual who is a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump. He tried to steal the last election using lies and violence to keep himself in power after the voters had rejected him. He can never be trusted with power again. As citizens, we each have a duty to put country above partisanship to defend our Constitution. That is why I will be casting my vote for Vice President Kamala Harris. Now, if I were Kamala Harris, I would hide this.
Yeah, that's the issue.
It's not her fault per se, sure. Right, that he's endorsed her. It's how you react to it.
Well, no, I disagree with that. It is her fault. I think that if you were doing your job properly, the Republicans like Dick Cheney would be alienated, right, and they would be off in the wilderness with no.
Well, no, but this is also classic. I mean, to some extent, it's classic Nixonian rat fucking, where, you know, I think like in, what is it, in the when McGovern was running, it was a different time, folks. I think didn't they have sort of like I think there were like some transsexual prostitutes came out and endorsed McGovern, the idea being that that would be, you know. So this is right, the 2024 damning version of that to some extent. I don't, you know, anybody can say anything. It's the part where she embraces it, and it's the part where liberals are just going, yeah, see, yeah. And which
right.
I have a different take on that. I think that she, Liz Cheney, is the Republican that Kamala is talking about to put in her cabinet, and that the quid pro quo was that Dick would also come out and support her publicly.
Yeah. I don't think this is rat fucking. I think they actually want Kamala.
No, I'm saying it could. Okay, you're right. Yes.
Yeah,
I think so. It does have that kind of taste to it as well. But the thing that, you know, and all the back and forth with everybody kind of yelling at each other and you know, going, hey, man, it's an existential threat. You take what you can. The phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, comes up all the time, which has been driving me nuts since 2016 when they first started doing it, when all these awful people came out for Hillary, because it's like, that's not an absolute. You know, most of the time, the enemy of your enemy is still your enemy. And it is, it's kind of classic, you know, David, you mentioned we did a podcast, the West Wing thing. It's kind of classic Sorkin West Wing brain where, you know, I mean, right before Biden dropped out, Aaron Sorkin suggested, he wrote that editorial suggesting that Biden drop out and endorse Mitt Romney to be the Democratic nominee. There's this weird thing with some Democrats where it's like, is it a daddy thing where it's like, if the stern mean daddy will come in and say nice things to us, everything will be good. I don't know. But what gets lost in all the shuffle and in all the back and forth and like, you're stupid and this is incredible, is that there are very much, you know, the right is really good at long-term projects. I mean, we've known this, but I remember seeing a video of Jerry Falwell recently, right before he died, and they were saying to him, you know, they're saying right before he died, you know, sort of talking about how the fact that he, you know, Roe v. Wade was still in place, and he was genuine. He had a big smile on his face. He's like, you don't get it, man. We've been working on this. He's like, I don't have to see it. My kids are going to see it. We've been working on this for a long time. This is part of a project. This is part of a project that the Republicans have been using since Trump came to the front, taking advantage of like that terror that he strikes for some reason in so many liberals' hearts, where they've been slowly kind of, you know, the Republicans that got alienated from their own party, like Cheney. I mean, people forget that Trump demolished Jeb Bush, you know, that whole mechanism. And, you know, this is their kind of infiltration of the Democratic Party and Democratic media, where you end up with people like Steve Schmidt and Rick Wilson and all those Lincoln Party, Lincoln Project grifters, and, you know, David Frum and William Kristol, you know, all being rehabilitated. George W. Bush has been rehabilitated, you know, Liz Cheney of all people. And it, you know, the thing has been, if you're watching, it's like, when are they going to get around to, you know, Dick Cheney? Because all of these people, you know, you do this, you soften them up, and then you slowly kind of infiltrate kind of quote-unquote liberal media and liberal politics, and everyone's okay with it. Yeah, as Dave said, it's like when Liz Cheney gets a job in the Harris administration, everyone's going to be fine with it because of shit like this. So this is a project. This is not them. The notion that they're recoiling in horror that Donald Trump tried to overthrow a presidential election, it's so fucking ludicrous on the face of it. I can't believe anyone's going for it.
Well, you know, let's actually take a stroll down memory lane and take a look at what Rachel Maddow actually broadcast before she had resistance brain, when she was actually considering people like Bush and Cheney to be the bad guys. Let's take a look at this clip from MSNBC, from Rachel Maddow's show.
On November 22nd of the year 2000, weeks after the presidential election that year, we still did not know who had won Florida and who had therefore won the presidency. Over 10,000 ballots remained to be counted by the Miami-Dade Elections Board. When Republican operatives who the Bush campaign had flown in from around the country heard that that count in Miami was going to go forward, the count of those 10,000 plus remaining ballots, those GOP operatives decided they would physically shut down that count. The two direct organizers of the mob that turned up at the Miami elections office were New York State Republican Party chairman at the time, Brendan Quinn, and New York Republican Congressman John Sweeney, who's now better known for losing his seat in Congress after multiple DUI arrests and domestic violence allegations from his wife and an odd proclivity for showing up at frat parties and having his picture taken there, too. The mob that the GOP sent to stop that count in Miami was billed at the time as a spontaneous grassroots uprising, one that just happened to be made up of no one at all from Miami, all Republican national operatives, including at least a half dozen who, according to IRS records, received payment for their services from the Bush-Cheney recount committee. Here were the Brooks Brothers rioters, you know, just a bunch of ordinary Americans who wanted to see justice done, who were moved to spontaneous protest. Rioter one here, Tom Pyle, an aide to Republican Congressman Tom DeLay. Rioter two, Gary Melfris, former staff director of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. Rioter three, Rory Cooper, staff member with the National Republican Congressional Committee. Rioter four, Kevin Smith, former House Republican conference analyst. Rioter five, Stephen Brophy, former aide to Senator Fred Thompson. Rioter 6, Matt Schlapp, Bush campaign staffer. Rioter 7, Roger Morse, aide to Republican Congressman Van Hillary. Rioter 8, Dwayne Gibson, aide to Republican Congressman Don Young. Rioter 9, Chuck Royal, aide to then Republican Congressman Jim DeMint. And Rioter 10, Lena McConkie, former assistant to Republican Jim Ross Lightfoot. Many of the Brooks Brothers rioters went on to pretty good jobs in the Bush-Cheney administration.
So, I mean, I thought we cared about democracy, the Constitution, I mean, the only difference between them and Trump is that they succeeded.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. They did a coup. They did using this, right? So the street riot is what that is, basically. And then you also had previous to this, literally kicking 100,000 black people off of the voter rolls. And then you got the legal apparatus getting involved. It was a basic coup that you would see in South America.
I mean, to paraphrase Trump, I think, like Cheney should have said, I like people whose coups were successful.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
If you just take out the part about the election, and Cheney is everything that they say is, what Trump is. He is the most anti-democratic office holder in at least modern, history that I know of. I mean, this is a guy going all the way back to when he was in Congress. He opposed Nelson Mandela being freed from prison. He voted to support apartheid over and over again. Like, his entire career is this terrible, terrible stuff. You know, Iran-Contra. He used Iran-Contra to try to increase the powers of the presidency. Like, everything he's done, and then he gets in office and it's the imperial presidency and right. They're ignoring everything, right? Torture is now legal and they can arrest Americans without warrants. Like, the whole thing is insane. And then they're like, Project 2025. It's like, that's what Cheney wanted. That's his dream.
I mean, it's not like some people, I think, buy the idea that, oh, well, it's just that Trump is so bad that we all have to come together. But that's not it. Like, the reason that people don't like Trump, so many of these people don't like Trump, like, if you really dislike Trump, but you don't dislike Cheney, it's actually about norms, not about politics.
It's only about norms. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, because you don't support a serial killer because there's a domestic abuser next door. Like, that's just not how it works. You can not like both of them. What about the meme that's right. Like, let them fight? Let them fight. Let these people have at it. The Republicans should be in a civil war.
And, it's also funny because it also is kind of useful for Trump, I think. He can now point to the fact that, Doug Burgum, right, who was like auditioning to be Trump's vice president on one of the Sunday morning shows was like, the Dems used to call this guy a genocidal, but I guess now they're going to be stumping for him. Which is true. And he made some joke about how Bernie could go with how Bernie could now go around, stumping with Dick Cheney. But let's take a look at Kamala's response to this and then Bernie's response to this. And then we'll talk more about because I think a lot of people don't remember what Bush Cheney really meant. Okay, let's take a look.
I'm honored to have their endorsement. And I think that what they both as leaders who are well respected are making an important statement that it's okay and if not important to put country above party. And I'm honored to have their support, and I think it's an important statement right now. A lot of what I think is happening, and I was just talking with some folks here in Pittsburgh about it, is that people are exhausted about the division and the attempts to kind of divide us as Americans. And them stepping up to make this public statement, I think, is courageous, but also for people like the folks I was just talking with, it really reinforces for them that we love our country and we have more in common than what separates us.
Mm. All right.
How is it courageous? I don't even, can you explain, like, in she doesn't mean that, but the person who's listening, like, what am I, if I'm buying this, I'm taking her at face value, what is it that Cheney's doing that is allegedly courageous? I don't freaking get it. He has absolutely no constituency left in the Republican Party. It's not like there's a whole lot of fans of the Democratic Party. Right. He's just this, it's like this is his way back in to some kind of respectability. Just he doesn't care what party it is. Like, how is this brave?
You know what else this is? It's so weird to watch this party live through Obama. This is what Obama did. Obama would like invite Republicans to movie night and none of them would come. This is the same thing. They're doing it all over again. And you're like, we did this. You look like idiots.
So insane.
What are you doing?
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, and the truth is, it's because they know how to do politics. And Democrats just, well,
yes,
you know, assuming Democrats believe in one-tenth of what it is they claim to believe in, they do not know how to do politics at all.
Right. I mean, I used to think they were just spineless and inept and afraid of their own shadows. But, you know, after reading Thomas Frank, Listen Liberal, I really am more of the idea that they do know what they're doing. They're just creating, it's an illusion of powerlessness, that they don't really want the things that they claim that they want.
Yeah.
Well, they don't want.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't at all. Yeah, they don't want any of that stuff. They're servicing the corporations and the rich, and then trying to figure out, you know, it always comes out mealy mouthed, but trying to figure out how to get elected by lying to everybody. I mean, that's why the Republicans are even close to winning stuff, is because they're honest. They're just evil.
Well, they're also, and if they did care, this is, and now here's a question. Is this the third or the fourth time? Do we count the first half of this election as one? This is either the third or the fourth time that they have run against Donald Trump, and the third or fourth time that Donald Trump has stood a very good chance of winning, and the third or fourth time that they've basically done the same playbook, which is just tell us how bad Donald Trump is. And so far, he's won once, lost twice, or lost once, which you have to give COVID credit for that. And now here we are sort of in a place where it could go either way. And you're like, they don't change the strategy. If they cared about winning, they know how to win. It's not hard to beat Donald Trump in an election in 2024, offer some policies that actually matter to people, that impact them, that are popular, that he will hate.
But they can't.
Yeah, exactly.
They can't. I mean, that was Sirota. Sirota, you know, said the other day, you know, you got the Venn diagram and you got two circles, and in the middle is just little tiny stuff that doesn't really change anything. And other than that, they can't support anything that the corporations are.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because people really think that they are on the right side, no pun intended, they're on the correct side. They don't realize, like, the game is, it's out of the bag. Like, Nicole Wallace, William Kristol, all these people are fixtures on MSNBC. It's not that they're brave. They've just switched teams. Mm-hmm. There's like a RNC to MSNBC pipeline that these people are part of.
Yeah, because it's the party. What's the difference between this party, the Democratic Party, and like Reagan at this point? Like, they have no public answers to anything. It's all tax breaks, and like it's all private companies can help us. And there's nothing about like, hey, let's tax. And from that taxes, we'll save stuff. They're just not doing that. Even the Build Back Better was all about giving money to private companies. There's no, like, if you really want to do it what FDR did. That's how you build back better. That's how you do all this stuff. But the whole thing is just, it's very comfortable for Republicans to go there because they're all about it's neoliberalism, right? It's just the perfect place for them to go.
One more thing I want to show is people may remember we had on Marianne Ingram, the very amazing woman. She's from Germany. She's a Holocaust survivor, and she's been protesting outside of the White House like every day. She protests the war in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza. And she also has a great book called The Hands of War. And she's just a really inspiring person. And I was talking to her because we're going to interview her in person. And we're trying to figure out dates where we can go visit her. And it turns out that today is her husband's birthday, Daniel Ingram. And so let's take a, we're going to show you his image, wish him happy birthday. And I'm going to read, that's them and from the White House. It's so cool. They're a great couple. Daniel Ingram has been a human rights activist with his wife, Marianne Ingram, since they moved from NYC to DC 1960 and encountered the incredible racism and denial of fundamental rights, including all voting rights to citizens residing in the nation's capital. As members of the Congress of Racial Equality, that's CORE, they battle racial discrimination in housing, employment, education, welfare, recreation, justice, taxing, banking, credit, and economic development. They also vigorously oppose police brutality and war and championed equal rights for women and for gays, and for the past several months have protested every day against genocide in Gaza. So happy birthday to Daniel Ingram. And thank you so much to Marianne for all that you do. And thank you, Wadesworth, for your donation. And we will see you next week. Is there anything else I need to announce? Oh, if you're watching this live, you got to see the whole thing. If you're watching this later and you want to see our chat with Josh and Dave, Josh Olson and Dave Anthony, about the Cheney endorsement of Kamala Harris, then please do that at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.